Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, I'm Callum Stoneman, and welcome to Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, our weekly look at what's new, what's trending, and what's going on, just generally, in the world of technology from a blind and partially sighted perspective. If you want to get in contact with us, you can email us, techtalk@rnib.org.uk is our email address. That's techtalk at rnib.org.uk. Coming up this week, we'll be speaking about accessibility with Craig Abbott from Tetralogical. And also, Toby Davy has been finding out about an art exhibit that includes immersive audio description. Joining me this week are Jackie Brown and Hubert Pavalkovich. Welcoming to you both. How's it going? Jackie, anything new with you this week?
Well, it's the time of year, I guess, where people are starting to think about their holidays. Maybe you're booked up to go somewhere, or maybe you're struggling with the accessibility of a website or a travel app. So that's an interesting take on booking up to go anywhere or planning a journey. What apps do you use? Do you find them all accessible? For example, I use the only one I really use, to be honest, because I don't really travel that much. So the only place I do tend to go to is Scotland to see my family. And that involves booking a flight with EasyJet. So I either, and more often than not, use the EasyJet website to do this. But I have on occasions used the EasyJet app, and the difficulty that I'm having and have had now for quite a while is the calendar aspect of it. So if you go onto the website, it's a bit of a fiddle to try and get the calendar up and choosing your dates. And there is also this one way or return trip combo box, and it can be a bit of a nightmare as well. And on the app, it's the same thing. It can be a real faff, to be honest, to try and get past the calendar and the fact you want a return trip.
Yeah, so I've I hate those calendar pickers, by the way, for dates.
Yeah,
just seriously, just give us a text box, or at least give us the option where you can just type in a date. But I mean, I've looked for holidays before. I've tried the On the Beach website a couple of years ago. It was okay. I find the biggest issue for me is hotels, because I never really know what I'm booking. Like, I know the type of room and stuff. You can find that out, but obviously a lot of it is pictures, and it's a little bit easier now with you can drag it into Be My AI or something and get a description. But I'm never really confident on what I'm booking.
This is probably an area I'm the least techie in a sense when it comes to booking travel abroad. I still use a travel agent to this day because I like to sit down and for someone to talk me through all the things I do not understand, because I don't get half of these hidden fees. There's certain costs there, certain regulations there or that, or there's a sneaky terms or conditions out there. I like an old travel agent experience still. It's probably the one bit when I like the old-fashioned aspect, because you can actually talk through it without kind of looking at it and going, I don't actually know what I'm looking at here.
Hubert, what's going on with you?
Right, so the caveat is this is currently predominantly an issue in the US, it seems, based on my testing. However, just a little warning to people about using Meta AI. Now, some would say that it's a common sense thing. However, I think common sense or not, it should always be advised. Can we be careful what we put to our AI chatbots, please? So there is a news story that I've spotted where someone on X has shared screenshots of their Discover feed in the Meta AI app, which in the UK version of this app isn't actually available. However, it does seem that some people's AI prompts are displayed for public viewing. And these aren't just kind of normal prompts. Some of them can be quite private. Apparently included medical records, confessions of affairs, crimes. And
I shouldn't laugh, but I love this story.
I love using the AI, but I have to say, this thing's you don't do. But I think there's a lot of hidden things there because people aren't aware of this. Now, the news article has asked Meta about this issue, and spokespeople from Meta have said that people's AI prompts are only shared if the user clicks the share button in the Meta AI app interface. Again, I've not seen any of this, so it might be something that's current in the US only, but could come to the UK, so be mindful. But when they have asked Meta why it thinks that users do it unknowingly, they have not responded. So I would say it's an advisable thing, so please bear with caution. But the advice is to be careful what you post to these AI chatbots because we hope that these things are private, but sometimes there's things we don't know. So when you use these AI chatbots, just be mindful that the things you post or you talk about may not be as private. So certain details, maybe talk to a professional rather than a chatbot.
I mean, that's there's benefits for us in terms of things like Access AI from Aira, which is, that does have that privacy aspect. I mean, it's still using a large language model, but they've gone to great lengths to make sure that it is private. But I don't think this is a blind thing. I think this is just a general thing. So I mean, yeah, if you are having an affair or if you've committed a crime, yeah, maybe leave AI out of that one. I would maybe say. Well, there's a bit of news from NVDA. So this has been in the works for a while, this new version. But NVDA 2025.1 has been released. In fact, I think now, a couple of days after that, they released 2025.1.1, which is just a minor bug fix release, but the overall 2025 release itself has a few new features, the most notable one being the inclusion of NVDA Remote. So this was previously an add-on, but it's now built in to the screen reader. So very much like Jaws Tandem, I guess, where you can go on to somebody else's computer with their permission, obviously. But if someone else is running NVDA, you can log on to their system and control it remotely. So we're really good for providing, tech support or fixing a problem or providing training. So before you had to go onto the add-on store or go onto the NVDA remote website and download the add-on and install it in. You don't have to do any of that now. It's just a checkbox in settings where you can enable it, and then it will show up as an option, and you can connect from there. Also new. Well, there's quite a few new things, but the other one that's interested me is speech support in Microsoft Office apps. So very interesting if you're using that in the workplace, because I don't know about you guys, but I've always found Jaws seems to handle Office apps a bit better. I found that NVDA can be a bit. I think the big thing for me, and I'm sure NVDA has this, maybe it does, but the big thing for me with Jaws and the Office apps is the virtual ribbons. Because those ribbon menus, I don't know about you guys, but I'd find them a nightmare to navigate around.
They're not the best, and they often can be quite. There's too many things in them, I think. They could certainly be organized in a better way because I always get lost in them and end up going to the places. And there's keyboard shortcuts for them, but they involve about 3,000 characters to remember, so that doesn't help either.
I think with the virtual ribbons turned on, though, some of those shortcuts don't work, do they?
Oh yeah, I have found that. Although to be honest, I think the Office apps are the one set of apps where I don't actually use the shortcuts because they're so like I don't see any logic to them. If you want to, I don't know if this is definitely the correct shortcut. I'm just purely making this up. But say you're in Word and you want to insert a table, it's like Alt N to get to the insert menu, and then I don't know, it's like R and then T and then S will put in a table. And I'm just like, what? Apart from the T in there, I don't really get where's that come from?
I tend to actually, when I want to do stuff, unless like the copy and the paste and the undo and or the select all, a lot of those you just know by heart because you do them for so long and you're always using them. But some of the actual those little shortcuts that you just said, I tend to just go. I think it's quicker just to go to that insert menu, and I have a browse. And in that way, in browsing all those menus, you get to know where some of the items are anyway, because you're learning as you go down those ribbons, and going across to the different aspects. You get to know where things are placed, and I actually think that's quite a helpful way, rather than just giving a whole load of shortcuts that you just hope are going to take you to where you want to be.
Well, there you go. That's the new version of NVDA. Hopefully, it improves some of that, and definitely good to have the inclusion of that remote access as well. That's going to make it easier for a lot of people. So, if you've got NVDA and you haven't already been notified, just go to the check for updates section, and you should be able to get it from there. All right, thanks, guys. Stick with us. This is Tech Talk. Now, obviously, on Tech Talk, a topic that comes up all the time is accessibility and the accessibility of the websites and apps and services that we use on a daily basis. And we're all familiar with some of the common accessibility issues that come up, and maybe something doesn't work with VoiceOver or you can't enlarge the text. But what can we as users do about it? And how is accessibility thought about from, let's say, a designer or a developer? How does it work in the real world? Well, someone who knows his stuff when it comes to this sort of thing is Craig Abbott. Craig, thanks so much for joining us. Now, you work as an accessibility consultant. In fact, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a bit about you and a bit about your background, I guess.
Thanks. So at the moment, I work as a principal accessibility specialist at Terrological. I mainly do consultancy stuff, working with organizations to try and do sustainable accessibility, not just to do audits, but to try and change the ways of working and change the culture and things like that so that they can continue to do accessibility after we leave, I guess. Prior to that, I've worked in UK government. So I was the head of accessibility at the Department for Work and Pensions for a few years, where we did a lot of stuff on accessibility policy and trying to get applications to meet the public sector body's accessibility regulations. Quite well versed, I suppose, in the legal ramifications of not being accessible, I suppose. We had conversations with the RNIB and stuff where when I was over there to make sure things were accessible and whatnot.
So you work for Techological. So what's your day to day, I guess, and in terms of the issues that come up and the things that you're commonly dealing with, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one because accessibility is so broad. So like a lot of people think it's just about screen readers and those sorts of things, but like every day can be different. I suppose it depends on who you're working with. It depends on what the needs are in those organizations. We do a lot of we I mean like any accessibility organization, we do audits. We work to the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. We'll assess services and say whether they meet the standards or not. But one of the reasons why I wanted to join Terrological was they do a lot of work on stuff that kind of goes beyond that. I mean, they're looking at, how does accessibility actually impact the user? Because I think a lot of the standards and a lot of the stuff around design and development and the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines often just focuses purely on does this pass or fail an assessment? But we know from, real world experience that something can pass an assessment and still be pretty unusable for people. So I guess day to day, I mean, we look at sustainable accessibility is the main thing that, I kind of look at, but that's trying to, I guess, do transformational pieces inside of organizations and try and look at strategy and roadmaps and how can you build those things into your organization so that you can hire people with accessibility skills and make sure that if those people leave the organization, then all that knowledge doesn't leave with them and make sure that, I guess like when you look at large organizations, things like security and things like development and technical architects, and there's all of these roles in an organization and there's established practice and there's established career paths. And for accessibility, a lot of those things don't exist. So when one person who's the accessibility person leaves the organization, a lot of the time that knowledge leaves with them, and then you're kind of stuck. So yeah, every day is different. We do a whole we offer a whole bunch of different services, and it means that we don't just get stuck doing audits all the time, I suppose, which any accessibility specialist will tell you that gets a bit tedious, I suppose, after a while.
Painful, yeah. You did a talk recently for Global Accessibility Awareness Day about the issues with pixel perfect design, and it's a really interesting talk. It's available on YouTube, and you can look it up if you're interested. But do you want to just kind of summarize that, because that's a really interesting topic and something that I've not really thought much about before.
Yeah, I think so. For context, I suppose my background is in design, but I also do front end development. But I'm a designer by trade, I guess. I was an interaction designer for many years, and I think it's interesting because this idea of things being pixel perfect. Designers spend a lot of time polishing designs and making them look. That we squint at the screen and we nudge things left and right by 2 or 3 pixels to get everything lined up perfectly. And in the real world, or at least in 2025, like you have no idea what your design will look like when somebody's viewing it. Like you don't know what size screen they're going to be using. You don't know what device they're going to be using. You don't know if they're going to zoom in the browser, if they're going to have it in high contrast mode. So there's this. I guess it's an unwillingness to relinquish control of the design, where designers are still, arguing over whether a gutter should be 10 pixels or 20 pixels, when in reality, nowadays, when we have design systems and we have algorithms that can calculate, margins and things to stay within a ratio of the font size and these sorts of things, so that everything. Just kind of you trust the system and then everything should work if you've built it right. And I think it's yeah the talk is often on just trying to let go, I suppose, of that control, because a lot of the times when we work with pixels specifically, it means that when people increase the font size in their browser, for example, it doesn't actually increase, so you can almost disable some of those accessibility features that come shipped with the browser.
I suppose it's kind of trying to be a bit too perfect almost.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. A user doesn't care if your margin is 8 pixels or 10 pixels. They just care if the text's overlapping. So I think as a designer who always valued function over form, I suppose, like I didn't really care how pretty my designs looked as long as they worked. I think obviously, when I worked in government, that was fine because gov.uk stuff is very simple, but that might not fly if you work for a startup or something where everything has to look pretty and whizzy. But yeah, I think as designers, we definitely try and hold on to too much control over how things look, and we actually end up creating problems for people.
I mean, on the similar topic of like, because obviously that talk was for GAD, for Global Accessibility Awareness Day. Do you think, because I think there's been a feeling over the years that it's just kind of preaching to the choir a lot of the time. People who are invested in it and who do these events, they already know about accessibility, or they've at least got some awareness. Do you think there are more actual designers and developers actually getting involved in days like that and really seeing the value of it from your experience?
I think so. It's definitely like, I mean, accessibility is definitely talked about far more these days than it did when I first started getting into it about 10 years ago. There's an increase in awareness, at least, whether or not there's an increase in, people getting it 100% correct, if that's even a thing that you can do. But I think there's definitely an awareness now more of the basics. I mean, things like alternative text and color contrast come up quite regularly, and even in teams where they're not necessarily getting everything to be compliant, they still often have, they'll run an automated tool and check color contrasts and those sorts of things. So I think it is increasing. I think it's definitely getting better, but I think there's so much, like I said earlier, there's a it's so broad, I think. It covers so many different aspects that unless you're like me, where you go down a rabbit hole on it and you love it and you want to learn everything about it. There's so much to learn that it can often be overwhelming for people, I think, or it can be some of the problems can be quite nuanced, and it's almost a skill in itself to figure out how to fix it. But I definitely think it's getting better, and I think people are definitely engaged. Like, I don't think I've met anybody yet who just doesn't want to do accessibility because they don't care or they think that it's not worth it. It's just you don't know what you don't know. And I think sometimes until you show people that something is inaccessible and you show why it doesn't work and you show the impact that it can have on people, they just don't know. And once you show them, they want to fix it. So, yeah, I think the attitudes often are correct. Just there's a lot to learn and it's difficult for people, I think.
It is a good point. It's quite easy for us as users, I guess, to go, oh, well, that's not accessible. Oh, they don't care. And to be fair, I think sometimes when you get in touch with companies and you get certain responses, it can feel like that. I guess the biggest challenge is actually getting to the developers and the people who work on it, rather than just your kind of, no disrespect to these, but your kind of customer support people who might just kind of go, don't really know what that means.
And I think that is a really good point, because I think especially in like sort of enterprise level organizations, when I say, I've never met somebody who doesn't care, that is literally talking one-to-one with people. And I think when you have an enterprise sort of size organization, it's an entity in itself, with its own sort of processes and bureaucracy and things that come with it. And I think you're right. It's like if you could show the problem directly to the team that's responsible for fixing it, they'd probably be quite bought in. But it's trying to get through that layers, them layers of contact and those layers of triage and those sorts of things to actually talk to the people that can fix it is often a challenge.
And how would you say is, like, before I let you go, how would you say is the best way for us to do that? I mean, as users, we who are not necessarily into, I mean, it's all right for people like me who is into software and into programming and can kind of explain things in quite a technical way. But if you're not that sort of person, if you've just come across an app that you need to use and you're using VoiceOver or you're using dynamic text or whatever and it's not accessible, what's Have you got any tips, I guess, on communicating that in a way that designers and developers would actually, that it would make sense to them? Because I think sometimes you can say, well, this isn't accessible, but like you said, that's so broad that it can kind of not really mean anything.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's I think a lot of it is, the word accessible almost, you say it so often that it then stops to make sense of that. It's one of those things where when you talk about accessibility, it can be so broad and there can be so many issues. I think focusing on what it is that you're trying to do and what it is that's not working has often been the way that I've seen people respond, or be able to grasp it, I suppose. Like, because if you just kind of wade in and say, this thing fails these workout criteria on this, this, and this, like, what are you going to do about it? And people don't understand what it actually means to fix those things. But if you say, look, I'm trying to do this thing, I'm trying to, I don't know, renew my driving license online or something, and I can't get past this part where it's, asking me for my date of birth, for example, because the date field doesn't accept the input when I'm using Dragon or something. That becomes a much clearer scenario where you say, I'm trying to do this, it's not working, and this is the problem. Because they might be able to do something where they can fix it. It might still not, I guess, meet the standards as such. But I think a lot of the time, again, like with users or people that are using the product, they don't always necessarily care that something's not compliant. They just care that it doesn't work or they can't do the task that they're trying to do. So I think in terms of, I suppose, communicating the issues, it's less about focusing on the compliance of the thing and the standards, and more just, that human element of like, this thing doesn't work for me because of X, Y, and Z. I do find that is, I suppose, the easiest way to get people to understand it, yeah.
Yeah, and that's I guess an interesting way to put it. It's kind of being clear, not necessarily on the tech, but on the steps that you're trying to do and where the issue comes in, you know, trying to be precise about how to reproduce it and basically, well, as I said, what the problems are, what's not working, maybe should happen compared to what is actually happening. Just being clear on those steps, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And I think this is it. I mean, if you try and raise an issue with software, they normally ask you, what version are you using? Like, what were you doing exactly? And they'll try and replicate those things. So I can appreciate why those things are important, I guess, if they're going to try and replicate the issue on the back end. But yeah, I often think if you can just, like, even, I don't know, like, if you can, a video or a demo or something, if you can actually get to the people that are going to fix it and demo the problem, a lot of the time it's like, oh right, okay, we can see that now. Whereas I think sometimes when you write a giant bug report, it can sometimes be really difficult to actually work out what was going wrong. So yeah, I don't know if, again, it's getting access to those people, but if you can demo the thing or do a video or something along those lines where it just shows exactly what's happening and what the problem is, it does help people to understand things.
And I guess on the iPhone especially, there's a built-in screen recording feature, isn't there, where you can record your screen and record the system audio with it as well if you're using something like VoiceOver. I guess that's a really useful thing to take advantage of.
Yeah, it's definitely becoming easier to do these things for sure. But yeah, I think anything like that, like it's the there's like an old prophecy that kind of I've seen circulated in some talks, where it's like tell me and I'll forget, and show me and I can remember, and involve me and I can understand. It's like I think it's that thing of when you just tell people about things, often they don't always get it. So yeah, if you can show them or involve them in it, they're much more likely to be able to help, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there you go. Hopefully some useful tips there on reporting accessibility issues and engaging with designers and developers. The problem with Pixel Perfect Design was Greg's talk. You can look that up on YouTube if you're interested in that kind of thing. But Craig Abbott, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
Time to chat about making art accessible for blind and partially sighted people now here on RNIB Connect Radio, as I'm joined by Priya Hirian, a British Indian contemporary artist who has an exhibition of her work on show at the Brick Lane Gallery in London from the 2nd to the 13th of July 2025, with audio descriptions of the work on display produced by Priya, inspired by her father's journey with blindness. Hello, Priya, and lovely to have you here with me on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hi, Toby. Thanks for having me on.
Of course, we're going to talk, Priya, about how you have made your artwork accessible for your father and other blind and partially sighted people in a moment through the use of the recorded audio descriptions and a couple of different types of technology too. But before we do, tell me a little bit about how you got into art and a bit about the work that you produced, which I think has a very sort of contemporary style and feel to it.
Yeah, I'd love to. So art was never really part of the plan, if I'm honest. So I came from a maths and actuarial background, so very logical, kind of very structured, but I've always been creative underneath. I just didn't think it was the real career path, I guess, especially growing up with certain cultural expectations. But over time, especially dealing with some major life challenges and a little bit of anxiety, painting kind of became something that I turned to for comfort. So it wasn't just a hobby at this point. It's kind of how I started to express what I couldn't say. And whenever I kind of felt I was struggling in the moment, it's just kind of how this whole journey began. And a little bit about my work, I guess my work's quite bold, emotional, and quite often surreal. I like mixing raw emotion with abstract surrealism, I guess. So with my latest collection, things like resilience, identity, imperfections, and I guess how we kind of suppress emotions to kind of just function on a day-to-day basis. So out of one of my most personal collections is this Marked by Light, which was experienced with vitiligo. So once I got diagnosed with that, I kind of came to the realization of I can't just hide behind a mask anymore. Like before, I would not very much use social media. I wasn't very much kind of into taking photos or wanting to be out and socializing. I mean, to be honest, most of the time my social battery is pretty drained anyway, but I am getting better. But with this latest collection, it's kind of become a symbol of transformation, like how what society sees as a flaw can actually be something beautiful. And that's what I kind of want to share with the world now.
I think it's really interesting because I think that sort of probably relates to your father, who I think started to lose his sight about 20 years ago. And he was very much involved and still is in technology, but also a great supporter of your work too. Tell me a little bit about his journey in blindness and how he has found ways of using technology in many ways to carry on with his life.
Yeah, so I mean, this did start very close to home, like you mentioned. My dad is blind. It started with a condition called Stevens-Johnson syndrome when he was quite young. From that, he slowly, gradually lost his sight. And then at the age of 32, he had this life-altering operation on his eye called an OOKP, done by an Italian doctor. I think he was probably one of the first in the UK, if I'm right. And that gave him perfect vision in the one eye. It was enough for him to drive. He had 19 years of perfect sight. Then, unfortunately, that eye gave in due to an infection, which we can't really moan about, if we're perfectly honest, as a family, because that life expectancy of that eye was 10 years and we got 19. So we were so blessed to even have just even one day, let alone the 19 years that we had. And then he tried the same operation on the other eye. Unfortunately, that didn't last as long as we expected. And it failed after the first year and a half, I think it was. So he has been one of my biggest supporters. He always has right from the get-go. And he's always been good at making sure we're well-educated and well-looked after. He's always done everything he can for us. And he had a computer business from the late 80s. Probably into the early 2000s, I think it was. And that was one of the largest computer companies in the UK at one point. And we always laugh to say that my dad was the brains, my mom was the eyes. So he would tell her how to create these computers and then she would be physically making them. And then so he started supplying computers to like schools, hospitals, large companies. But obviously I was quite young at that time. But then when it kind of got into my artwork, it kind of hit me one day that, like, actually, he can't experience any of my work. Like, he'd seen my stuff as I was growing up, my stuff that I did at school, and he knew I had that artistic flair, as did his sister. So he was just like, okay, obviously runs in the family a bit. But he never really got to see my true potential because I haven't really unlocked it or shown what I can do until more recently, because I never really showed my work, not even to family or anyone. It just kind of stayed in my little art room. So that's where we kind of started discussing, well, how can we get you to be able to see and experience what I've actually created? And I wanted him to feel it the way others do. So we tried like them apps, like Be My Eyes, I think the app is. And it's brilliant. He uses that on a day-to-day basis when he's got to find something, when he wants to use, I don't know, the microwave or the oven. He's great with the Meta glasses now. And the voiceover on the iPhone is brilliant. So he has loads of ways in general of getting about and doing his day-to-day jobs, obviously with the help of others most of the time. But what we realised is with art, that app doesn't really give you the true feeling and the true perspective of what you're seeing. And I guess that just comes with the nature of the art. If it was very realistic and it was portrait work, it could probably explain it extremely well. But when we tried using a number of the apps to take pictures of my work, it was getting the colors right and getting the general gist, but it wasn't really giving across everything that it kind of meant, because obviously it's trying to merge things that only unless you can see it would you really understand it. So I kind of wanted him to feel the way others do. So I started recording voiceovers myself. And then I thought, well, I don't want to just do dry descriptions, like how we hear the voiceover talking in the background. I thought, you know what, I want it to be a bit more immersive. I want to have the emotional audio behind it so we can get the full experience. And then I started adding in music, and it kind of took from there, really. I thought, well, actually, if Dad will enjoy it this way. And I played it to a few of my sighted friends and family who had come and seen a few pieces of my work, and they were like, actually, we really enjoy this. So it made me think, actually, even people who are sighted can enjoy it as well. So even though it started off with the audio description specifically for my father, I thought, why not try and make it immersive for everyone? So then I've started to do a version which is audio described with the music, but obviously it's a little bit more descriptive of the actual image and a little bit less of the emotion. And then I have a more emotional side, which kind of depicts the feelings behind it, again with music. And I've got a sassy, cheeky version, and I've got a kind of emotional and quite deep version as well.
And I think you've used different types of technology for blind and partially sighted people and sighted people to listen to the recordings, to the audio descriptions in the gallery spaces. You've used QR codes, I think, and also I think in the gallery in Brick Lane, I think you might have an iPad in a fixed position for people to listen to the recordings. Tell me a little bit about the sort of, I suppose, those choices in different types of technology. And has your father made any suggestions on what technology might be best for it?
Yeah, I mean, right. Well, we started probably the beginning part was let's create some sort of braille. So we thought, okay, he's got the braille machine. We can maybe do the descriptions that you normally put at the bottom of each image. You tend to have like the name, the artist, the size, the price, etc. And we thought, well, we could put that in braille. And then as we started talking about it, we thought, well, realistically, that's not great because you can't have someone feeling against the walls in the gallery because they could, I don't know, touch an artwork piece or they could potentially break something. So we thought, okay. And then it's quite laborious. Like you can end up having these massive books of just braille and it can be quite intimidating and it takes away from the experience of what the person's actually there for. So we scrapped the idea of braille. Then I had a thought of being able to potentially create a textile version of the pieces, but because it's contemporary abstract surrealism, I guess there was no way that a textile would be able to portray the actual image to someone without them being able to see it. So then we got onto the voiceovers and we thought about having a button somewhere on the side of the picture or somewhere on the side and then a speaker. And then we thought, well, if there's other people around or they then click on the next picture for the voiceover for that one, then too many voices, it could be disorientating to him. So we went with, okay, it needs to be done by headphones, via someone's phone, so then they can have their own experience. And most people nowadays, as they're roaming around, they have their AirPods or some form of headphones with their mobile phone. And I've noticed from what my father says is most of the blind community tend to go with iPhones because the voiceover is quite good. So I thought, okay, let's go along them lines. And he has used QR codes in the past. So I thought, okay, well, if he was to use something like the Be My Eyes or an app along that kind of wavelength, he could show the camera and it will pick up the QR code and it will take you to my website. And then on my website, I've got all the audios recorded and all it is a simple click of a button. And I'm in the process of getting the website fully voiceover accessible. So I don't know if you've noticed, but my father always has issues with certain websites or certain apps never having the specific button labeled. So we'll go over it and it will be like button, button. And I'm like, that actually means back, or that one is the submit button. So I was like, okay, the website needs to be solely accessible for sure. So then when I had my previous gallery exhibit at Espacio Gallery a few weeks back, I realised that the QR codes were quite hard for some people. And I guess that's where the difference comes in generations as well. I guess I've grown up with technology. I'm so quick to use QR codes and things. And then I realized actually not every age bracket can do that. I noticed some people were picking up my headphones, then using their own phone, even though they weren't connected. And I noticed that if people who are sighted are struggling, the last thing I want is someone who's visually impaired coming and feeling even more out of their comfort zone, because you already have that fear and that anxiety when you're going places about, is it going to be accessible? And all these other questions must come in your head, like as they do with my dad. So as I've thought going forward to Brick Lane Gallery, is that having an iPad with headphones attached on a cord, the person comes along, puts their headphones in, one tap of a button, and it goes through my artist bio, each image in turn. So then if someone sighted does it, they could see each image and it will be pointed to, or it will have an image to match the one that they'll be looking at. And if it's someone who's partially sighted or completely blind, they'll just be able to put the headphones on, press the iPad, which will have a voiceover on it, and away they go. It's just one click of a button, which I feel is better. And there's no need for them to roam around or feel like they've got to be searching around for QR codes.
Yeah, I suppose that's probably an easier way of doing it. And I suspect in the future with things like Meta glasses and stuff and things like that, you could probably just look at an image and it would then trigger something. So you listening to your audio descriptions, is that something that you think might happen in the future?
Yeah, I mean, like that's what I'm trying to change in the art world, if I'm perfectly honest. I feel like galleries can be quite intimidating. So even when I've sometimes walked into one, I felt like I kind of don't belong. And you're not allowed to touch anything. There's rarely any context behind anything. And you kind of have that feeling of, if you don't get it straight away, you just feel art maybe not for you. But that's not true. I was like, to be honest, most artists, myself included, are probably the least intimidating people you'll meet. We just want connection and we want people to love our work. We want to be able for people to enjoy it. And I'm just trying to bridge that gap so everyone feels invited and not excluded. So, I mean, in an ideal world, accessibility wouldn't be a feature. It'd kind of be built in from the beginning. So I'd love to see audio descriptions as standard, tactile experiences, maybe soundscapes. People could go as far as even having like scent-based installations. And it could be from the way where you walk in, if you've got your Meta glasses on, or even if you haven't, you pick up a set of headphones. And as you pass, or as your headphone connects to, I don't know, maybe a dongle with each piece, it starts to read off what the piece of work is in front of you. Because I feel like art should never feel like a private club. It's meant for everyone.
I think that's so true. It's so true. I mean, art should be accessible to us all, you know, whether we're blind or partially sighted or sighted. What would you like people visiting Brick Lane or going to listen to the audio descriptions on your website to come away with from seeing and listening to your work?
I guess for me, it's a case of people feeling like they belong and that they can also embrace art. Like, I want them to feel the emotions that people that are sighted can feel as well. It's not just beauty for the eyes. It's a feeling. So I guess for me, I don't want anyone to feel excluded. I don't want anyone to think twice, oh, well, art's not for me because I've got this disadvantage. I don't want people to feel like that. And if I can get other artists to feel this way as well, there'll be so much art out there and people will come up with different ways and different creative ideas of making art accessible.
Finally, Priya, if listeners would like to find out more about your artwork, how to listen to the audio descriptions and find out more about the show of your work at the Brick Lane Gallery in London from the 2nd to the 13th of July 2025, where can people go to find out more?
Yeah, so they can find me on Instagram, and my Instagram handle is at Priya Herrian. I've also got a website, which is www.priyaherrian.co.uk. The same Instagram handle is the same that's on TikTok. And my email and my mobile numbers available on all the social media platforms, Facebook included, and on my website. So you're more than welcome to drop me a message or even give me a phone call. I can always relay any information that's needed.
That's wonderful to hear. Well, thank you very much indeed, Priya, for chatting with me here on RNIB Connect Radio, telling me a bit about your work, your father, and why it's so important for art to be accessible to us all as blind and partially sighted people.
Yeah, thank you so much. And at the end of the day, I just want people, whether they can see the work or not, to just feel it. And if my art can reach someone's heart before it reaches their eyes, then I guess I know I've done a good job, right?
Now, today we're chatting about accessible technology and the positive impact it can have on supporting an individual's independence and enabling them to have a full and fulfilled life. Joining us now to share her personal journey with accessible technology and what has worked and perhaps what hasn't worked for her is student Aliza Rehman. It's so nice speaking with you, Aliza.
Always a pleasure to be on the show and always a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, Aliza, let's start with your current level of vision. Where are you at the moment?
So at the moment, you could say that I am virtually totally blind. I have no vision anymore that includes light perception in the right eye, which was due to being diagnosed with a condition called keratoconus last year. And then in my left eye, I only have light perception.
Okay, well, that's your vision currently, but I know your sight started deteriorating quite suddenly whilst you were still in school. So what tools did you reach for to assist you as you were kind of going through that almost like transitional stage with your sight loss?
I mean, growing up, I was learning Braille, even though I had a little bit of vision. It still wasn't enough to, let's say, be able to navigate a school environment with large print. So I was using a Braille note taker, the Braille Note Apex and the Braille Note Touch Plus, both of which you can find and purchase via Humanware. I don't know what the current note taker is, but they're the two that I have used. I was also very reluctant to using VoiceOver on iOS. I was a stubborn teenager, I feel like, not wanting to use those things because I could see my phone and relied heavily on Siri. But when I was 16 and my vision started going, I realized that I needed to rely on VoiceOver. And now I've become quite confident in using it. And yeah, you can say I'm a fan of Apple. I have an iPad, I have a MacBook, I have an iPhone, I have a watch. So we love Apple here.
It is like the company does such amazing accessible tools. So I'm not surprised. Now, you're in which year of uni are you at the moment? Is it second, third?
So I've just finished second year and I'll be going into third year in September.
That's very exciting. So what have you found has helped you the most during this stage of your life whilst you're studying?
Becoming a lot more confident in using a laptop. So again, working on a MacBook, love Mac. You know, there's so many good features that you can use, you know, things like Word, Pages, the web, which is really good when you want to sort of copy and paste links for your bibliography. That has helped. You know, I've been able to use that in conjunction with a smaller Braille display, the Brailliant, which again, also you can purchase from Humanware. And again, I've been using my Braille note taker, as you kind of can gather that I still love Braille. And it's a skill that I advocate for that. Yes, we have this amazing technology, you know, that we can use on our phones, our tablets, our computers. But I just think that, you know, ultimately to be able to read and write, Braille is the go for me. And I, you know, I still like to keep that up quite a lot.
Mm. And I think with Braille, what often comes up as a really big benefit is really learning the grammar, which for you as a writer is something that's really important.
Oh, yeah. And I was working at RSBC a few years ago and speaking to a lot of parents, I was quite shocked that they were getting their child quite immersed onto a computer. And I just kind of said that, you know, if it was a normal child, they'd be learning their basic handwriting, learning how to spell, learning how to write. And a computer is not going to teach you that. You know, your child isn't going to learn through AI, because that is not how they should be taught.
Well, Alisa, is there something that you have tried over the years that perhaps didn't quite work for you?
Quite a hard one. I think for me personally, I was always very reluctant to use assistive technology growing up, even when my Braille note would break down and then when it used to get fixed again, because I had an experience where one kind of broke down to the point that I lost all my work and I had to wait so long for a new one. And even when that broke down, I just became traumatized that what if it happens again, especially during exams where I don't know whether a time bomb just used to tick off in the tech. I used to be like, okay, we're not going to work for her today. And, you know, we're not going to make this exam work for her. I just think just that trauma of when it doesn't work, that kind of has set me back in the years. But I guess now that I, you know, have loved to use it and see its benefits, I guess I'm starting to overcome that trauma a little bit.
It's almost as if you collected a really nice toolbox of assistive technology. So if something doesn't work, you know there's something else you can use as a backup or something else that you can try as well.
Yeah, exactly. Which is where me having found out ways of learning how to use Apple technology by myself rather than relying on, say, school or uni to be able to provide that training has really helped me, because if I know that if one piece of tech breaks down, I've still got the ability to touch type, which again I was also taught at school.
Alisa, is there any, I know you have quite a few different things you absolutely love using, but if you had to choose one thing that you couldn't live without, what would it be?
Personally, and now I know a lot of people say their phone, which I can't either, but I think personally my computer, because I just love the feeling of being able to type on a physical keyboard and be able to do things like that rather than sort of using a touch screen. My perception would have been different a few years ago, but now I would just say it's my MacBook.
What would you recommend for, let's say, someone's new to sight loss? What do you think is a really good entry point accessible technology that you personally think they should start because it's going to really help them?
I would start off with Apple, because it's a universal device. Like, lots of people own iPhones, iPads, MacBooks, etc. And, you know, you can activate accessibility features within your settings without having to pay extra money to be able to use it. You know, for example, like JAWS or other sort of like Zoom text software that you'd have to fork out so much for. Sometimes you can't even afford it unless you kind of are at uni and you could perhaps get that funding through DSA, or if you're working, through like Access to Work. So personally, I would say Apple. You know, you can have it speak, you can, you know, activate voice features like VoiceOver, speak selection, Zoom text. You can use Siri, you know, voice dictation when you want to write a text or an email. And then once you've kind of gradually built that confidence, you know, you can move on to a Mac. And that is how I learned, you know, how to master a computer. And I'm kind of like, yes, I want to learn how to use Windows now.
Yeah, I think it's, I guess, starting there and then having that next step in mind is a really good goal to have. So you mentioned some of the grants or technology grants that are available there. Have you ever used any of them for your studies or for when you were working?
So DSA, yes, that is the primary you know, place for when you start university. So when you apply for student loans, and if you are disabled, then there is an option there for you to apply for disabled student allowance, and you can get all the assistive technology, whether that be hardware or software, through that. And yes, when I was working for RSBC, so I got Access to Work, you know, where I was able to again get MacBook, because I wasn't acquainted with Windows and I just can't let go of a MacBook, really.
No, I completely understand that. Well, Aliza, there's so much new technology coming out each year. Is there something that you're really excited to try in the future? I know you mentioned trying out Windows, but perhaps anything that you maybe even want to see released maybe over the coming years?
I mean, I've heard so much about the, you know, the Meta Ray-Ban glasses. I've heard so much about that they're so good in terms of reading things out to you. And I am wanting to get a pair because I think one of the things I struggle reading is PDFs. And I know a lot of other VI people might be able to agree with me on that because they're not the most accessible to read, which is sad because, you know, nearly everyone, you know, half my uni texts come as PDFs and you have to go through the hassle of trying to convert them in like Word, and they can read PDFs. So I think I would be quite inclined to actually get those.
Oh, that would be amazing. Well, Aliza, if you do get that pair of Meta Ray-Ban glasses, hopefully we can touch base and hear your personal review of how you find them. But for now, thank you so much for speaking with us today on RNIB Connect Radio and sharing your journey with accessible technology.
My pleasure. And, you know, anything to help our community make life better, I'm all for it.
That's all we've got time for this week. Thank you so much, as always, for being with us. And if you've got any comments or questions or tips that you want to share, let us know. You can drop us an email or a voice message to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. We'll be back with you same time, same place next week. But from me, Callum Stoneman, Hubert Bavalkovich and Jackie Brown, bye for now.
See you next week.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.